I resolve, therefore, as the force of the coming year made, and to speak to you along such lines as I trust may be instructive to those who know it not, in the general plan of salvation begun by Brother Michael, culminated in Christ, and made known to us by the revelation of the Holy Spirit. In the first chapter of the book of Hebrews, a book, by the way, unlike all others in the Bible, in that the letter addressed to them has no introduction, no greeting, no salutation. Paul, the supposed writer of it, delves right into the sublimity of that which he had in mind, and that was to convince the Hebrews, Christians that dwelt in Palestine, that Christ was superior to Moses, and that the gospel transcends the Jewish law. The book abounds with arguments to that extent, culminating in the story that Jesus Christ died and suffered outside the camp, which indicates, of course, the Bible teaching that he suffered outside of the Jewish economy. In that letter, Paul begins by saying, God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken unto us by his Son. And then he ascribes certain characteristics of that Son. One, whom he has appointed heir of all things, and by whom also he made the world, who, being the brightness of his glory, the express image of his person, and upholding all things with the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high, being made so much better than the angels, as he hath by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. And there's a wonderful statement. The record says that God, at sundry or at divers different times, and in divers or various manners, God spake unto the fathers. He never spoke to the mothers, nor to the sons or daughters, but he spoke to the fathers in various ways, one of which was direct, of course, as he talked and communed with them. Another, sometimes by signs and symbols. Again, he spoke to Moses through the burning bush, through Belshazzar, by writing on the walls of the temple in which they were, and various others. But God has spoken, and thus man is complimented in that God recognizes his ability to comprehend the simple things thus proclaimed unto him. Now, that's the way it was and used to be for 2,500 years, when God was governing the people through the Father. And because of that fact, it has been quite correctly called the patriarchal age. The patriarchate meaning father, and the archetype meaning government. Hence, a government of the people through the Father. God made the revelation to him, and then in turn expected the Father to relay heaven's will unto the entire family. The family, therefore, was the unit, and the Father was the one through whom they could approach God Almighty. Now, that's the way it once was, but that's not the way it is now. I want you to follow down the line and get a background of that which I hope to have to say later on. In the very beginning, there was instituted a system of worship. When the first pair, Cain and Abel, were born upon the earth, they offered sacrifice unto God, the oldest element of worship that we have today. God demanded of them an animal sacrifice. I'll not stop to discuss the idea that Cain substituted, and therefore God frowned upon it as a warning to all who are to come, that substitution will not avail for the direct statement of God's word. After that, we have the story of Adam's family, by the way, in the fifth chapter of Genesis, and there are 10 generations on down to the flood. Here they are. There was Adam, and then Seth, and Enos, and Cainan, Mahalaleel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. 10 long generations, averaging more than 800 years per generation. And during that time, but one thing is demanded, namely, to offer animal sacrifice unto God. But in the course of time, women were born upon the earth as well as men's children, and the sons of God looked upon the daughters of men and saw that they were fair to behold. And they selected and chose for themselves wives as they wished. Generations began to be born upon the earth, and with that, wickedness likewise made its appearance. I'd be afraid to say that woman was responsible for it, but there was no sin especially on the part of children until such things came to pass. And God saw, therefore, that the wickedness of man was great upon the earth, that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was evil, and that continually a state of depravity almost prevailed. And God wouldn't stand for a thing of that kind. Hence, there went forth a decree that all things in whose nostrils was the breath of life was to be destroyed from the face of the earth. Hence, the great baptismal flood came upon the world, and all except Noah and his family, together with just such animals as God wanted to carry over, were born across the great flood. And hence a new era began. Now, therefore, we have Noah and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And since all others were destroyed, God said to Noah just what he did to Adam: multiply and replenish the earth. And but for the fact that Noah carried out that admonition, we wouldn't be here this afternoon. We therefore can trace our ancestors back to Noah, and there we stop with the flood. Hence, there are three sources from which the world, as it's populated today, has come. I just raised a point with you for your study a moment. Are you a Shemite, or a Japhethite, or a Hamite? You're one or the other. I think you're an exceeding fair audience, characterized by possibly more than the average intellect, but do you know just which one of the boys you are, so to speak? And lots of people have never stopped to think along that line, and yet it's the little end of the taproot of that which ought to be understood by all men. Now, the Bible declares in Genesis, the 10th chapter, these three sons and their posterity. And take up the first one, Japheth. Japheth had seven boys, and here they are: Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. And the Bible declares that by these were the eyes of the Gentiles divided or settled. Well, of course, that brings on further talk just what constituted the eyes of the Gentiles. And you find throughout the Bible, as well as historic matter, the eyes of the Gentiles represented that country bordering upon and contiguous to the Mediterranean Sea. Like the island, for instance, of Spain, which is practically one, and of Italy, also of various Sardinian, Corsica, Cyprus, and likewise the British Isles. Now, in that part of the country, Western Europe, the sons of Japheth settled. Well, how do you know that? Well, the Bible just simply says so, that by these were the isles of the Gentiles settled. Now, you can study from there on down the line and trace humanity, and you will find that throughout the passing of the years, they remained there multiplying. And finally, that company that came across from Old Plymouth Rock in England, landed on our Plymouth Rock off the coast of Massachusetts, were those who came from the ancestral line of Japheth, the son of Noah. And since the people of America are settled largely by them, why, take it in this audience this afternoon, all of us, so far as I'm able to observe, we are sons of Noah through Japheth. Hence, we are Japhethites. I doubt if there's another in the entire audience. If so, he'll be caught in the next discussion of matters. Now, the next thing is that Ham had four sons with pretty names: Cush and Mizraim, Phut and Canaan. Well, they settled in Africa. And you ask, how do I know? Simply because of this one fact. the very names of those sons are translated into countries and have borne those names throughout the ages gone by. For instance, Kush is translated Ethiopia. Mizraim means Egypt. Lud means the Lydians. And Canaan refers back and has kept the same name of one of the boys. Hence, the sons of Ham settled in Africa. And somebody said to say, well, our Negroes are therefore descendants of Ham. I don't know whether they are or not, and I don't think you do. Now, I grant you that their suspicion is not lacking on two grounds. First of all, the first of the colored race that you and I know anything about, they came from England and from Africa. First of all, from Africa and then through England unto this country. That kind of looks suspicious. And then again, Ham's servants were to be slaves or servants to the other, his sons. And until the last few years, in the days of Ms. Roosevelt and others, the Negroes were servants. And not so much so now, and are striving to reverse relationships between them and us. But that's the size of it. Now, the fact that they came from Africa and that they had generally been servants, that might look quite suspicious, but it's not conclusive that they thus sprang from Ham. Well, the third son, Shem, had five boys. And here are the five: Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Now, where did they settle? And that's a matter of study, not only in the Bible, but outside the Bible. The study of that science called ethnology, the study of the races of mankind. Well, until a few years ago, Elam was a country bordering on the Persian Gulf. It's now Iran. And Asher, well, you can almost see the word Assyria, a country in the term Asher. And then Arphaxad, the great desert, if you please, of Shinar, a Chaldea. And then Lud, the Lydians, and Aram, the Syrians, all of those north and east of Palestine. Hence, the sons of Shem settled in what we call Asia. And you trace them by the countries that bear their names until this good day. Therefore, you have the distribution of the sons of Noah, the sons of Japheth in Western Europe, sons of Ham in Africa, sons of Shem, if you please, in Asia. Well, now let's go again. Commencing with Shem, who was a brother of Japheth, and our uncle at the beginning, trace down the line of further. And you have Shem, Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Shelah, Nahor, Terah, and Abraham. And you come to Abraham, 20 generations down from Adam, and you know something about him. Now, who is Abraham in the flesh I'm talking about? He's the descendant of Noah through Shem. Well, who are we? Descendants of Noah through Japheth. At the beginning, we were first cousins, but you know, after several generations, we don't count kinship unless some of them are quite wealthy, and then if it's the 40th cousin, well, we speak of Cousin Willie and Cousin Susan. But that's the size of it. Now, what's our relation to Abraham in the flesh? Practically none whatsoever, except all of us face back to Abraham, on back to Noah. Well, go ahead further with the genealogies. Abraham lived to be quite a long spell upon the earth, married, and then God made a demand of him that he'll leave his kindred and his father's family into a country go where he knew not how. Thus he went. But when he was 100 years old, his first and only son by Sarah, the chosen one, was born, Isaac by name. Isaac lived to be 40 years old before he ever married. And then he married Rebecca. They lived together for quite a while, by the way. And hence, in the course of time, Jacob and Esau were born when Isaac was about 60 years of age. And thus you have the tracing down the line. God had said to Abraham, in thy seed shall all nations be blessed. Well, at that time, they didn't have any seed. But Isaac was finally born. Hence, that promise was repeated in Isaac. And then the course of time, Jacob was born, and God said through Jacob, all nations of the earth should be blessed. Now the promise to Abraham was twofold. First, God promised physical blessings or temporal blessings to be his. One of which was, I'll make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. I bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curse thee, and thy seed shall become like the dust of the earth, or the stars in the great heavens above, without number. And then the second promise, a spiritual one, in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Hence, that's the promise that came on down the line. Well, in the course of time, Jacob married. His mother, having sent him back to her brother's home in old Padan Aram, to the house of Laban. And there he went, by the way, on the journey, had a wonderful dream, as you know, a ladder, the foot of it from the earth and reached into the heavens, and angels ascending and descending. And Jacob pillowed his head that night upon a stone. He had the mother earth for his bed and the covering for the candidate heaven, and the glittering stars, his chandeliers. There he slept and had that wonderful dream. He awoke and said, this is none other than the doings of the Lord. He took that stone which had used for a pillow and set it up as a pillar, P-I-L-L-A-R, and there made a vow, namely, that if the Lord would bring me on my way in peace and let me come back to my country, give me food to eat and clothes to wear, of all that I ever have, one-tenth shall be the Lord. And hence the foundation of that which became a law throughout the Jewish reign upon the earth. Well, he went to Laban, and he met the girls out drawing water for their flocks. And being a gallant young fellow and hospitable in nature, why, he said to the girls, let me draw the water and water the flocks and the herds as the custom was. So he did so. May I just stop and sidestep a minute? So you girls, let me tell you one thing. Young men that wanted to seek your hand and heart, before they marry, they'll draw the water for you, do all their other errands round about, and glad to do so. Why, they'll even walk around the automobile and open the door and help you in, poor little helpless thing. But after you marry, 3 months or 6 months, and you suggest, well, I'd like to have a bucket of fresh water. Well, I guess you know where the well is. Go get it. And if you're going to be in the car, I'm already in. Come on and get in. They get helpless before they're married, but exceedingly strong afterwards. When old Laban, his uncle, saw that he was taken in by the love that he had for Rachel, he made a hard bargain to him. Now, Jacob did to him, rather, which was accepted. That is, to work for him 7 years if Rachel might become his wife. Well, he accepted a proposition of that kind, and regardless of your judgment, that's the record as found the Bible. I've often thought that is a wonderful hard deal, but when I began to think about the initial cost of the present and the upkeep, I'm not so sure that they're any higher then than they are now, by the way. And Jacob, when the wedding was over and the veil removed, found himself married unto Leah, the older sister of tender eyes. He rose up and called attention to that fact, and the father pacified him by saying, well, son, in this country, it's not lawful for the younger daughter to marry before the elder. And if you ever therefore marry Rachel, you must first of all marry Leah or get somebody else to. Well, he worked for another 7 years, and Rachel was given to him after the first 7 days of it. Hence that story. Well, on down the line, we have the sons of Jacob. And here they are. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Dan and Naphtali. Gad and Asher. Issachar and Zebulun. Joseph and Benjamin. Hence the 12 sons. And then Dinah, the daughter, the 13th child. Or rather, making 13 in all. Hence you have traced down from Shem, by the way, look at it, from Shem down through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and his 12 sons. And how much time has been covered? Well, just count it up a minute. From the time that God made this promise to Abraham in Haran, there were 25 years before Isaac was born, because the Bible said he was 75 when he left Haran. Isaac was born when he's 100, so there's 25 years. Well, all right. Now, until Isaac is born, there's 60 years gone by. And when Jacob is born, there are yet 85 years remaining. Now add. 25 plus 60 makes 85, and 130 years was Jacob when he stood before Pharaoh. And you've got the sum of 215 years from the time that God made the promise to Abraham in Haran until they went down the land of Egypt and there became servants. Who went down? Jacob's son? Any of Jesus' boys go down? No, sir. Any of our kind in that company? No, sir. Well, who only went? Sons of Shem, which we are not. Sons of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. They are the ones that went down the country of Egypt. And there they bowed their backs to the rays of an Egyptian sun. And for 215 years more, they toiled and labored after the building all of the 15 pyramids along the banks of the historic Nile and fitting the coffers, the treasury of the pharaohs that were already overflowing until finally God heard their cries and decided to deliver them. Hence, he selected one of their own number, and a hint to the sufficient ought to be wise. He never got a stranger or a different race to send down to convert them and to appeal to Pharaoh, but one of his own sort. Pharaoh was to be converted to the idea of letting the people go, and there's a wonderful job ahead. At the age of 40, Moses went down to deliver them, and he saw an Egyptian slay one of his brethren. He killed him and hid him in the sand. But that thing was found out, and he fled to the backside of the land of Midian and kept his father-in-law's flock, having married the daughter of Reuel, Zipporah by name. And then after 40 years more, when he had ripened and became rich in experience, God said to Moses, go down and deliver them. Now you heard this morning, if you listen at all, over the radio, Brother Lab, that the miracles performed were just such as to overcome Moses' objection. First of all, shall I tell them who I sent me down? I am that I am. They won't believe me. Perform the miracle with the rod cast from the ground, your hand in your bosom, water of the Nile poured out upon the dry ground, becoming blood. Moses went, stood before Pharaoh and looked him square in the eye, and suggested, let my people go out of bondage across the Red Sea 3 days' journey in the wilderness, that they may worship. Well, the plagues came upon them to convince old Pharaoh that the Lord was back of it. And finally, the nominal assent was given. So they gathered together. Now, catch up with the number for just a moment. There were 70 souls down in Egypt, 70 males, counting Jacob and all of his sons. By the time God appeared to them to deliver them, there were 600,000 men, besides women and children. And now count again. Remembering that families back there were much more prolific than they are now, it's safe to count 2.5 or 3 women and children for every man. Well, based upon that, you have a multitude of something like 2.5 million people, possibly 3 million. They were gathered together. There never has been an army under one command as great as was that assembled under the leadership of Moses. And on the night preparatory to their beginning, in the city or district of Ramesses, in the land of Goshen, northern Egypt, there God said, this shall be the beginning of month, the month Nisan, or Abib. Therefore the Passover was held on the 15th day of the first month, and they started out after that eastward bound for the Red Sea. They went on to Succoth, and then they came to Thyatira. And there they were over against Baal Zephon and entangled in the wilderness. Behind them, there was old Pharaoh with his host. Out in front, there's the great Red Sea spread out possibly 2.5 or 3 miles wide. On either side, there were the mountains in which they were entangled. God said, Moses, stand still and see what the Lord will show you this day. And having gained their attention, The next command was to go forward. And as they marched through, the walls of water stood on the heap on the right and on the left. And look at what a picture there was. Behind them, that is the shore of the Red Sea. On the right and on the left, the waters were walled up. Over them was a pillar of fire because they crossed by night, about 3 o'clock in the morning. And over on the far shore, yonder is the other shore. Hence, they were hidden, literally submerged, covered up, and they passed through on dry ground. Paul said they were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. That was not a real baptism, but this, Paul said, was a typical one. These things happened unto them for a type, or for an example. And on the farther shore, they sang the song of glad deliverance. Now, who did? Well, the sons of Abraham. Any of our kind come up out of Egypt? No, sir. Well, who came up? Those that were in Egypt. Well, who were in the country? Those that went down. Well, who went down? Sons of Jacob. Do you know that's exceeding important for that which is to follow? And I beg you to have that impression made upon your hearts and minds now. Nobody went down Egypt except sons of Noah through Shem. And bear in mind, we are sons of Noah through a different branch. We are Japhethites. None of our sort ever went down. None ever served. None ever came out. But the sons of Shem. Hence they march on from the Red Sea. And I skip some of the places, but finally they come to Mount Sinai. Exactly 50 days after they had left Ramesses. And while at old Mount Sinai, four things quite prominent were done. First of all, there was the giving of the law. Second, there was the worship of the calf by Aaron and the slaughter of about 3,000 souls. Third, there was the building of the tabernacle, God's house of gold upon a foundation of silver. Fourth, there was the numbering and organizing the people ready for a forward march toward the land that flowed with milk and honey. With those four things having transpired, another year has gone by. And hence, they marched from Mount Sinai with these preparations background up north old Kadesh Barnea, at which time Moses sent out 12 spies to view the land of Palestine, which lay just to the north of it. They came back with their report, and I'll not stop to delineate it, but only two of them declared that we can take it, Caleb and Joshua. God said, because of the evil report, you shall wander for 38 more years, a year for every day, and counting the 2 years already passed, makes a journey of 40 long years. And thus they wandered up and down that terrible wilderness, where if a crow were to fly over, he'd have to take his lunch along with him. And there they were for that long time. Well, after the passing of that, they tried to go into the land of Palestine from the southeast, but the Edomites from Esau, son of Isaac and brother Jacob, twin brother, the Esau people forbade their going through their country. And they pleaded with them, well, let us pass. We'll not bother anything. We just propose to go along the king's highway. We'll not bother your stuff, nor destroy your property. But they refused. They had done a long detour around south of the country of Moab. And while in that section, the people east of the Jordan, a wonderful country of the Ammonites, and you know who they are, sons of Lot by his own daughters. The Ammonites had two kings. The country was so large, they had one in the south and one in the north. Old Jabin in the south, whose capital was Heshbon, and then up north, there was old Og, whose capital was at Edrei. And thus they feared the coming of the people of God. So they sent for Balaam to come down and curse them. He came, built an altar, and went to pronounce a curse upon God's people, but every time God changed that curse as it would be into a blessing. Finally, the southern king decided to march out in the country of Moab and have a battle with Moses, lest he come and destroy our country. That was done across the brook Arnon from where he lived, and the result was that he was slain, and the southern part of eastern Palestine was then subdued.
Moses marched on up north and slew all of the great giant, 13 feet and 4 inches tall, I think he was. And he was slain. And then the entire eastern country of Palestine lay open unto Moses. There he planted 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh, on the ground that your warriors will one day pass over the Jordan and drive out the 7 nations on the western side and there occupy the promised land. All of that was done. Now, with that as the story thus far, I want to suggest to you some things about the happenings at Mount Sinai. Right there, the law was given, the 10 commandments, if you please, written on both sides of 2 tables of stone, this side and that side, by the finger of God. And then God said, Moses, now you take a book and write up what we call the statutory law and dedicate it with blood and thus sanctify it. Hence the law, the Constitution, the great Magna Carta, and the statutory part were there inaugurated. I'm going to ask you people in all candor, to whom was that law given at Mount Sinai? Well, of course, your answer is given to them who were there that day. That's just good sense, and that's Bible. If I were called upon today to put my finger upon the error in the religious world, I'd suggest it's a failure to recognize that the law given by Moses, by God through Moses at Sinai, was given only unto the sons of Shem, while they think, the religious world, it was given to all men for all time. There never was a greater error, nor a more egregious blunder, nor fatal mistake than that very conception of affairs. Why, nobody was present at Sinai except the sons of Shem, and of Abraham, of Isaac and Jacob. We were not represented there. Well, just let me read to you, by the way, from the 20th chapter of Exodus, the first part of it. Moses said, I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Who is the thee? Well, those who went down. Who went down? Jacob and his 69 sons. That's the total number. Any of our folks in the company? No, sir. I can't emphasize that too strongly. I am the Lord thy God that brought thee out of Egypt. Thee, the ones that went down, sons of Abraham in the flesh, which we are not. Well, again, from Deuteronomy 5, in the first part of it, Moses said, talking to them, the Israelites, the Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Now, just a word. Horeb is the name of the chain of mountains, and Sinai is a single peak. Like out west, for instance, there's the great Rocky Mountain chain. Old Pike's Peak is part of it. The tower's far above the rest of it. Now, just so here, there is the chain of mountains called Horeb, and there's old Mount Sinai lifting his head 6,500 feet above the sea level. Hence, the Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us. Well, what us? With us who are alive here this day. Well, I'd hate to think that a man couldn't see that if he really had his attention directed to it. Now, Lord, with whom was the covenant made? With the people that had just come up out of Egypt. Was it made with anybody else? No, sir. It was made to us who are alive here this day. How to get that? Well, I want to ask further. When was it made? Well, look at Hebrews 8 and verse 9. In the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. That's the when of it. Now, to whom was it given? To those who were present at Mount Sinai. Well, when? In the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. Well, why did he give it? What's the purpose of the law, by the way? Well, I have one. Galatians 3 and verse 19. Hear it. Paul said, brethren, wherefore do you serve the law? It was added. Now you ask, added to what? Well, maybe to the promise. If not, it simply came in to play its part, having a special purpose, and then to pass out at the exit. Hence, the law was added because of transgression. Now, that's the reason the law was ever given, the transgression, by the way. Well, just what does that spell? You know, friends, when people don't know what the law is, they never are conscious of the fact that they've transgressed it. If I were to come into your city of West Monroe, not knowing what a red light in the middle of the street stood for, I might just drive on through, know nothing about it. But some fellow wearing blue coats and red buttons and a great club would halt me, and he'd make me to understand, you have violated a traffic law. I become conscious of my wrong. Now, people back there did things of which they were not conscious that it was wrong, no doubt, but more especially because of transgression. Esau went and married a daughter of Heth or of Ham. It was a displeasure to his father and mother. If Jacob had done that same thing, Jesus Christ could not have come of pure Abrahamic blood. Therefore, in order to keep the bloodline pure, this law was added. And Paul said it stood as a middle wall of partition. Partitioning what? Sons of Abraham over that side from the rest of the world. And don't you boys over there even make eyes at Japhetic girls or those of the sons of Ham. Don't intermarry. Why? We've got an objective in view. The seed promised by Abraham is yet to come. That seed is Christ. Therefore, until it comes, I set the Abrahamic family off to one side and keep the bloodline pure. While driving down here yesterday, I saw quite a number of herds of white-faced cattle. And I observed one thing about it, as I always do. They were in a field by themselves. Now, why'd you let them run with the short horns and the black Angus and the Jerseys and the Guernseys and the various breeds of cattle? Well, you want to keep your white face pure and the Hereford line unaffected. Therefore, fence them off. If some of you women are in the chicken business and you started out to have a flock of chickens of the Rhode Island red breed, what do you do about that? You build a fence round about them. Why, you don't let them run with the Wyandots and their Plymouth Rocks and with the various other breeds of chickens. Why? You'd have a general mixture of the thing. But you fence them off, lest there might be a transgression and breeding outside of the Rhode Island red line. But when the cockerel is born way down the line, and he fits exactly what you had in mind, then what? I don't care now anything about it. I'll tear down the wall and thus let the whole thing go out of fashion. Well, that's the idea exactly. Why was all added? Because of transgression. I want to keep the Abrahamic sons and daughters marrying among themselves and not among others of different races. Well, all right. For how long, by the way, was all that given? Let's just hear that same verse. Wherefore, brethren, serve the law, it was added because of transgression until. Well, that fixed the limit of it. Well, until what? Until the seed should come. What seed? The one to whom the promise is made. Now, what seed was that? Just drop back to verse 16 of Galatians 3. Now, to Abraham, to his seed, with the promise is made, he saith not the seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. Therefore, the law was given because of transgression until Christ should come. While this meeting has been announced until next Sunday night, you won't expect me here on Monday, not Tuesday. Well, why? The word until fixes the limit of it. And thus you have it in this case. The law was given until the seed should come to whom the promise is made. Now, what's Christ's attitude toward it, by the way? In the Sermon on the Mount, he anticipated that the disciples might misunderstand his relation toward the law. Hence, he said, Matthew 5, 17, think not. That is, don't you think that I'm come to destroy the law of the prophets? I've not come to destroy, I've come to fulfill. And I'm going to do it. The heavens and the earth may pass, but one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law until all be fulfilled. Christ lived under the law, being a Jew, born under it, lived under it, died under it. And on the cross, one of the seven utterances was, Father, it's finished. What's finished? That thing that I came to fulfill. Well, what is that? The law and the prophets? Now, do you believe that or not? That's in John 19:30, where Christ said, it is finished. What's finished? I came to not to destroy, but to fulfill the law and the prophets. It's done. Well, what became of it? Paul said in Colossians 2 and verse 14, hearing, Christ blotted out the handwriting of ordinances which was, not which is, which was against us, which was contrary, and took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross. And there's where it was when he said it's finished. And then again, Ephesians 2. He is our peace, who hath made both one, and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us. Now, both who and us who? Well, the Jew and the Gentile. He is our peace, who hath made both Jew and Gentile one, having broken down the middle wall of partition between us, and having abolished. Now, do you know what abolish means? Make it as though it had never been. Having abolished in his flesh the enmity. What was that in it? Even the law of commandments. Where? Contained in ordinances. Well, why? That he might make in himself out of the twain or two one new man, so making peace, and that he might reconcile both Jew and Gentile under God in one body by the cross, having slain the enmity thereby. Friends, it's gone. What's gone? That law emanating from Mount Sinai, lock, stock, barrel, touch, hole, and all, by the way. Christ gutted it out, took it out of the way, made it to the cross. And someone's ready to ask, well, Hardiman, do you think the Ten Commandments are now binding? No, sir. And I'm sure you didn't fail to get that. They never were binding upon anybody, except those five Jews, sons of Abraham. Now, that you may not misunderstand, when Christ dedicated and instituted the new covenant, and God began to speak to us through his Son, nine of those Ten Commandments, in principle, were transferred, and they are a part of the new covenant, sealed with the blood of Christ. One of them was left out. I don't propose to observe it. Neither do I observe the others because they were found at Sinai. I observe them because they're found under Christ and not under Moses. But the fourth one, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, is not found in the law of Christ anywhere. And it'd be difficult to keep that in this country of ours. Of that there'll be more to say later on, however. Christ is the end of the law. And I just wonder if anybody ever questioned which end was he. Well, of course, he was the beginning, because the law was inaugurated 1,400 or 1,500 years before Christ was born. He's the latter end of it. He fulfilled it, took it out of the way, made it the cross, and gave to us a better covenant founded upon better promises. May I close by reciting to you from the 8th chapter of Hebrews, beginning with verse 6. He is our peace who hath made both one. So said Paul to the Hebrews, Ephesian brethren. Now, he has given us a better covenant found upon better promises. For if the first covenant had been faultless, what was the first covenant? One made at Sinai. If that had been faultless, no place should have been sought for the second. But finding fault with that, he said, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant. And it spells it N-E, that be new, with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. For how is it, Paul? Not according to the covenant I made with our fathers. It's not to be like that. In the day that I took them out of the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because They continued not my covenant. I regarded them not, saith the Lord. But this is the covenant I make with them. I'll put my law in their minds. Where should you put the other one? Upon tables of stone. I'm not going to have it that way now. I'll put my law in their minds and write it in their hearts. I'll be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me. Well, back there, every child born in Abraham's house or bought with his money was a member of the Abrahamic covenant. The child didn't know it, but when he got to where he could understand, somebody had to tell him, Son, you are a member of the covenant. Recognize that fact. Paul said, it won't be that way in the new covenant. Back there is first membership and then knowledge. Up here they shall know me from the least and the greatest. Therefore, under Christ it's knowledge and then membership. I'll be merciful, said he, to their unrighteousness. Their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. Now in that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. That which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. Therefore, we're living under a different covenant from that characteristic of Abraham and of Moses' day. But if a Jew back there believed and obeyed the law of Moses, I want to ask you, what would it make of it? Any man, a son of Abraham, believing that law and doing what it says, what would it make of him? Well, I think you know, it would make of that character a Jew. Now, you would ask, well, what kind of a Jew would it make out of? Just a Jew, by the way. A Jew. It wouldn't make anything else, just a Jew. Can you catch on to the latter part of it? If a man obeys the new covenant, believing it with all of his heart, what will that make of him? Just one thing. It won't make a Jew, nor a Gentile. It'll make a Christian. Nothing but that and only that. So this afternoon, should there be one or more present who understands God's will, wants to become a member of the new covenant, the invitation is gladly extended. While together, we stand, please, for the song.